Some of us are very sure that we will see our dead loved ones again. It is a central feature of many religions and belief systems, the idea that once our bodies give out, our souls, our essences, continue in some place beyond where we are now. It's comforting for sure, and science pretty much rules it out. But science does offer the possibility of extending life, or pausing it now and continuing it later, or some other way of staying on Earth longer. Our guest this hour considers both the afterlife and the longer life in his latest book. Michael Shermer is the author of Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael Shermer makes his living as a skeptic. He's the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a columnist for Scientific American, an op-ed contributor to many other publications, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University in Southern California. Just by quirk of scheduling, we replayed an interview with him last Friday about his previous book, The Moral Arc. So welcome back, Michael Shermer.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeffrey. I appreciate that.
I'm a little surprised, given that your role as a skeptic and questioner of traditions, that you haven't actually gotten to life after death before now.
Yes, well, I'm just kind of working my way through the big topics, you know, God and religion and morality, and now the afterlife is kind of the next big one. And also, it's not something I thought that much about as a younger man. Now that I'm in my early 60s, you know, I'm like cramming for the final, maybe. Contemplating, you know, what might come next or not. But it really is a fascinating subject. And it's not as dark as it sounds like talking about death. It's not really about that. It's really about, you know, how we live our lives now, which is kind of how I finish up the book. But I'm fascinated by the idea that, you know, that we're just naturally inclined to think that there's something like a soul, and therefore the soul continues on in some other place. And as I document in the book, this starts pretty early, like at Paul Bloom's lab at Yale. They show these little puppet shows for young children. They're like age two or three, about age three or so, where a mouse gets munched by an alligator, and then they ask, you know, well, where's the mouse? And these little kids said, well, you know, it's at this other place, and he's hungry, and he misses his mommy, and, you know, Bloom tells this effect, you know, natural-born dualism. That is, we're naturally inclined to be dualists and think that there's body and soul, brain and mind, corporeal and incorporeal, and that there's something else, and that if there is something else, then that has to go, it has to continue on somehow beyond the physical body. I mean, that's the idea. But as you noted in the introduction, science doesn't support that. I mean, we've never found any place that people go to and so on. So that's, you know, how I kind of introduce the subject and go through all the different scenarios.
I'm surprised at how widespread it is. I mean, the belief in an afterlife of some kind is way bigger than the percentage of people who actually go to church or have a regular religious observance.
It certainly is, yes. Pretty much three-quarters of Americans or so believe in an afterlife, and certain religions are much higher than others. Mormons are the highest, about 95%. Jews are much lower, at about less than half, and it varies across the religious landscape. But strikingly, I found a study on many thousands of Americans that found about 13% of Americans are atheists, but about a third of those atheists believe in the continuation of consciousness after death. Now, these aren't obviously believing in a Christian-type heaven or a Muslim-type heaven, but probably something like a New Age spiritualist-type argument, sort of a quasi-Buddhism, that consciousness continues on in some quantum field of some sort. Maybe there's a force out there that you know, reunite with, something like that. There's a whole bunch of these New Age ideas that have risen in prominence over the decades since the 60s, when mainstream religions have slowly ground down in their numbers. Those people that are leaving, the so-called nuns, you know, that's a third of millennials and about a quarter of all Americans, tick the box for no religious affiliation now. It's huge. But they're not joining the ranks of atheists. They're not subscribing to Skeptic Magazine, my magazine, and signing on to the, you know, the full-on non-belief. No, I think most of them are going towards some of these New Age ideas that still is comforting in the sense that, you know, there's something else beyond the here and now, and you get to go there, you know, after your physical body dies. And you know, I understand the pull of that. You know, it's psychologically reassuring.
Well, as you point out in the very beginning of the book, it's hard for us to imagine. I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, being in a dark place with our eyes closed and not hearing anything. We're talking about not even being to that level of awareness.
Yeah, so, you know, when we think about, well, what happens when you die, you know, I often say, well, you know, where do you go? It's, well, you go to the same place you were before you were born, you know, which baffles most people. But I wasn't anywhere before I was born. Right. So even the idea that you're going somewhere, or even the atheist idea that you go nowhere or there's nothing, you know, the words are limiting because, you know, no thing, nothing, no thing. It's a thing that's not. It's not even that. You can't even really conceive of what it means. It, the nearest analogy we can have would be general anesthesia. You know, you're given the injection and you're told to count backwards, you know, 10, 9, 8, boom, lights out. And there's no consciousness in between. At least with sleep, you have dreams. Your sleep is broken up with dreams, so there's some conscious state going on. With general anesthesia, it's just nothing. It's just lights out, and then, you know, hopefully you come back. But there's no sense of, like, how long was I out for? You just have no idea. And so death is probably something like that. It just lights out. That's it. And, you know, so when you ask people, imagine yourself dead, you know, they can't. No one can, because to imagine anything, you have to be alive.
Right.
So this presents something of a paradox. You know, we see people die around us, and all 100 billion people that came before us, you know, they're all dead. So clearly it's a reality of our lives, and yet you can't conceive of what it even is like.
Life after death and perhaps prolonging life itself, both dealt with in Michael Shermer's book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. And we'll come back and talk more with Michael and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. Definitely a compelling subject. Requires us to think a bit about where we are in the universe now and where we will be down the road. You can join the conversation by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Michael Shermer, once again, the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's written a new book called Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Yeah, it's the same Michael Shermer we had a rerun on last week talking about his earlier book, The Moral Arc. Didn't know when we ran it then we'd have him on today, but here he is talking about life and what happens after life and whether we can prolong it. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a reference in the book to strength of belief in the afterlife. It looks like since 9/11, did that ratchet things up for us a bit?
Yes, certainly. Well, certainly 9/11 focused our attention on the fact that religious beliefs and the belief in the afterlife can be exceptionally powerful. It can drive people to fly planes into buildings, for example. Now, I understand, you know, the hijackers and terrorists have other motives, political motives, and so on. But underlying all the is this belief that when I die, I'm going someplace and I'm going to be rewarded for my martyrdom. That's what martyrdom is. For my actions, I am rewarded in the next life. So if you took that away, it's not that it would completely end terrorist attacks. I mean, atheist Marxists in the 70s were only too happy to blow things up and so forth in the name of Marxism, which is sort of a faux religion. But the belief in the afterlife at the moment certainly motivates some people. But I should add, you know, most people are not like that. You know, to them, you know, the afterlife is something much more glorious than martyrdom. And so that's a good thing. But I think the idea that the theisms, the monotheisms, Christianity, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the interesting thing there is that there's no agreement about what this afterlife is like. And when you read the history of heavens, it's interesting that there's no sense of progress. Like, we're getting closer to understanding what heaven is like. It's just where you happen to have been born by chance, what epoch you were born into, where you were raised, and what your family believed. These are the determining factors for what heavens are like. Versus science, where, say, if you went to India, you wouldn't find that they have a different kind of physics there or biology. No, we are discovering things that are really there, and that's just not the way it is with the ideas about heaven. They're geographically bound and chronologically bound, and so that's revealing to me.
I should point out that the work in the book is not just you sitting down and pounding out your own thoughts. You draw on a lot of other people's work and studies and bring in a lot of science and some philosophy as well. We get to Stephen Cave and the mortality paradox in the book, which is some interesting stuff in here about some issues that we would have if we wanted to continue to go on in life after death.
Yes, well, excuse me for a second there. The main focus of my book is scientific attempts to live forever. That is, I call this afterlife for atheists, that there's a lot of people now and people that have the backing of a lot of Silicon Valley, you know, billionaires and companies like Google. Google has a company called Calico. They want to see if we can get people to live for a couple hundred years. So first of all, I debunk the myth that people now live twice as long as they used to. This is not true. People centuries ago, some of them lived to be their 80s, 90s, or even hundreds. What's happened because of public health measures, vaccinations, so forth, more and more of us are getting up to the upper ceiling, that upper ceiling being about 120 years or so. No one's living past that. There's no breakthrough the upper ceiling yet. And so what the goals of modern medicine are just to get more of us up to the upper ceiling, living quality lives as long as we can. To make that leap is going to require something dramatic, and that's what a lot of these pioneers, these techno-optimists are working on, is how to do that, and we're not there yet, not even close. So forget all the things you hear about, you know, the first person to live 1,000 years is alive today. This is not the case, not even close. I mean, it's an enormous problem. In your mid-80s or so, all systems in your body start to fail. And they just start to break apart. So it's not like there's a magic bullet. If we could just take this one supplement, this one type of food or whatever, or this one medicine, or have your blood cleansed or whatever, there's a bunch of different theories, but none of them work. It would take something like genetically re-engineering the cell to really get around this problem. So some of the other people I deal with are the cryonics people, for example. You freeze the body at, you know, minus a couple hundred degrees, and so all molecular activity stops, so there can be no more aging. And then we're going to wake you up in a couple centuries or 1,000 years from now or whatever, when we have the technology to revive you and fix all the things that were wrong with you, keeping in mind that you're frozen on the worst day of your life, the day you're dead. So, you know, that. And so I've looked into that, and I went and visited some of these places. I know these people. No one frozen today is ever going to be brought back. I'm quite certain of this. Even though they have some new techniques, I'm pretty sure it's not going to work. And because a frozen embryo, say, that's used for IVF, which does work, an embryo is so tiny compared to a brain. And the brain is where you are located. So then, you know, the more modest ones that I think have some hope is just, you know, diet and exercise, don't smoke, that kind of thing. But again, none of that's going to break through the upper ceiling. That's only going to let you get closer to the upper ceiling, living a quality life. And, you know, so then we get into the crazy stuff, like, you know, we're gonna copy your brain and put it in a computer and turn it on, and you're going to be inside the computer and you can live forever there. Well, you know, the problem is, first of all, we're not even close to being able to do anything remotely like this, and it would be centuries probably at least before we could even conceive of doing this. And the other problem, though, is that copying you and putting it somewhere else is not you.
Well, there's a great example you give in the book about imagining that you appear to have died in a bicycle accident.
Yeah. So I'm imagining a sci-fi scenario where, you know, a company like 23andMe clone has a copy of my DNA ready to go, maybe even a body ready to go. And my wife is, you know, with an insurance company that backs up my mind in the cloud every night when I'm sleeping. And, you know, then I'm apparently killed in this bike accident. I'm a cyclist and I like to go fast down hills, and so of course she's brokenhearted, hopefully, but no problem. She calls 23andMe clone, has the body brought out, calls the iCloud company, and they insert the pattern of my memories and information into the brain of the clone, and turns it on, and boom, there I am. I'm back home, and everything's great. But turns out that I went up the side of this cliff on my bike accident. It was a very, very cold day, and I didn't die. I was just down there for weeks, and I came to and crawled out of the ravine and went home to surprise my wife, only to find her in bed with me. You know, so, you know, I'm standing there going, "Hey, dude," you know, and he's like, "No, it's I'm Michael Shermer," and I'm standing there going, "No, I'm Michael Shermer. You're a copy of me, and get the hell out of my house."
Right.
So the copy, just like a twin, no twin looks at their sibling and thinks, "Well, there I am."
Right.
You know, these are autonomous people, and so a copy, however it would be, a clone or a mind uploading scenario, something like that. None of that is you. And even if it was done in a way that it was a perfect simulacrum of you, every last memory, that there is no such thing as you. Let's say you copied me now, I'm 63, and includes all my memories. But the problem is that, say, the memories of when I was 30 are different now than they were when I was 30. And so the memories are always changing and edited over time. So there's no snapshot that we would copy that really, truly represents you in its entire entity. The only you is you right now. This is it. So none of these scenarios, I think, can work.
We're talking to Michael Shermer about his book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. He spends a fair amount of the book considering our belief that we'll see our loved ones someplace beyond the mortal plane that we're on before. A lot of people do believe in that. But also, a lot of people think in terms of what we've just been talking about, science, where we can actually prolong life, keep ourselves on the earth longer, forestalling any need to worry about what happens after death. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Feel free to get in here at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. One contact already from Jamie in Medford wants to know what your thoughts are on reincarnation.
What's my thought on reincarnation? Well, I'm skeptical, as you might imagine. The problem with the reincarnation scenario is that there are far more people that have been born and lived and died than there are today. There's about 7.5 billion people alive today. Demographers estimate that about 100 billion people lived before us, lived and died. So of the 7.5 billion people now, all of which presumably have souls, how are they going to fit 100 billion souls that are dead into the 7.5 billion bodies? Where do those souls go? You know, and that's just one problem. The other problem, you know, is sort of geographically speaking, the souls all seem to hover around the subcontinent of India. And that's where the focus is on, you know, believing in reincarnation primarily. So that tells us that this is more of a belief system than it is a reality. And then finally, I do delve into the weeds of the details that people claim, like this little boy is born, in 1990 something, and he has these memories as a young boy of being a fighter pilot in World War II. And anyway, the parents at some point connect him and his stories to the story of this World War II pilot who actually was shot down and burned to death in the cockpit of his plane. Anyway, when you actually look into the details, first of all, this young boy who's now a teenager has no memory of any of this, or even the stories. You know, he got it from his parents, you know, later. You know, they kind of concocted the whole thing as he was a young boy talking about these things, which I do believe, because I remember when I was a young lad, my father was in World War II in the Pacific, and I used to just be so fascinated by his stories. And I built little model airplanes of World War II fighter planes, and I read everything I could, and so on. And that's what, you know, young boys like to do. And so it's entirely possible that this young boy had these fantasies and made up these stories and fantasized about being a pilot. I used to do that. And then the parents kind of took and ran with it. Okay, so there's hundreds of story cases like this, and none of them are validated by external sources. They all require some kind of stretch of the imagination. Like I can see that the scar on your left side sort of kind of matches the point of entry of the bullet of the person you think you were centuries ago, sort of, kind of, you know, and it's all this, you know, sort of long reach for validation that from a science perspective is not really there. It's just not. So reincarnation doesn't provide evidence of the afterlife, and neither does near-death experience. I have a whole chapter on those. Those are really fascinating because they're real in the sense that people have powerful experiences, quite a few. And these are well documented now. But we know it's brain chemistry because we can replicate them in labs. You can spin pilots in a centrifuge till they black out, and a significant percentage of them have these kind of out-of-body floating dreamlike experiences, white light at the end of the tunnel, that sort of thing. You can, with open brain surgeries on epileptic patients, you can wake them up and tap around in the temporal lobe and find an area in the temporal lobe just above your ears where the patient lying there on the hospital bed awake will all of a sudden feel like they're floating up by the ceiling, you know, looking down at the doctors. And so that's just brain chemistry. That's happening in the brain, not out in the world.
So all the things that people claim to see in near-death experiences are really, you think that's the brain's shutdown sequence?
Yes, that's what we think. It's probably something like as oxygen starts to shut down from the outside of the cortex toward the inner side of the inside the brain. So you know, the last thing to go is your brainstem, which is what keeps your heart beating and your lungs breathing and so on. You know, that's the most protected deep down. So that's the last to shut down. First to shut down are these areas like the visual cortex in the back of your brain. So as that starts to shut down, vision starts to go dark, you know, except for the little center point of the retina there, where you then see something like a tunnel and a little light at the end of the tunnel. That's where we think that comes from. And, of course, they're personalized. You know, I saw somebody, you know, I saw my lost loved ones there on the other side. You know, those are unique to the people that have these experiences. But the general process of the shutting down of the brain. And then there's other interesting research on, ecstasy, MDMA, ayahuasca, some of these hallucinogenic drugs. You know, the fact that they can work on our brains means that there's a molecular lock and key in there for some naturally occurring chemicals like that. And so it's possible that these near-death experiences also help us transition from life to death with, you know, minimal anxiety. Because, of course, it's going to be traumatic for most of us. And so it's a way of kind of just easing you into the process that you can't stop anyway. So, you know, maybe that's an adaptation by our brains to ease that transition.
Michael Shermer is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. I'm struck by one of the most famous near-death experience stories and how much it pivots on a single tennis shoe.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. It gets passed around everywhere you read on near-death experiences. And, you know, it was never confirmed. It was, you know, one account. And the person that, okay, so this woman has, you know, a cardiac arrest. She's rushed into the ER at the hospital. She has another cardiac arrest, and then they save her, and then she comes to and says, whoa, I had this really weird experience. I was floating out of my body, feeling and so on. I look down and see the doctors and so on. And there's a tennis shoe on the windowsill. You know, what a weird thing. And so her nurse practitioner later went and checked. Now she's in a different room. Went and checked this other room she was previously in, and sure enough, there's a shoe on the ledge. This is the reported story. Now, so people have tried to track the story down. They can't find the woman. They can't find the nurse. You know, no one else heard any of this. You know, so we only have one account by one person told and retold. And you know, as interesting as that is, it doesn't really get us anywhere in terms of science. This is why you have to have corroboration in science. You have to have some kind of validity methodology set up because, you know, just who knows? People exaggerate, they misperceive, they mishear things, they tell the stories over and over and change the stories. You know, none of that's reliable evidence.
But it seems like if all of us don't have a story about what feels like a contact with someone on the other side, they at least know somebody who does. And you provide one of your own in here, the story about your wife's transistor radio. Tell us that one.
I do, yes. I do want to show that I'm sympathetic to people having powerful experiences. I've written about some of my own, like when I was abducted by aliens in the middle of a long bike race in which I was sleep deprived. You know, I've had these. I understand it, and so I wrote about this particular one where my wife's from Cologne, Germany, and we met online, and then met in New York, and very romantic, back and forth. And then at some point, we decided, well, you know, we might as well just get married here, because immigration issues and so on. I live in California. So she just decided to stay. We went in to the Beverly Hills courthouse and just got married, boom, right on the fly. And then I, you know, called my family and friends, come on over. We're going to have a little get-together tonight and celebrate and so forth. And by then, though, she was feeling kind of bad about everything because she didn't have any friends or family there. It's just all my friends and family. And she was raised by a single mom and her grandfather. Her grandfather since passed. She has fond memories of playing with her grandfather, and he had this little radio, this Philips 7700 transistor radio, just a small little palm-sized radio that they used to listen to music to on, and she's always kept that, and she shipped that out, and I tried to get it working. It wouldn't work, you know, new batteries, it fiddled the wires, all that, and just threw it in a drawer in my bedroom and forgot about it. You know, so you know, 6 months later, you know, we're at the little ceremony at my house, and she's feeling bad. We go to the back bedroom just to have a quiet moment together, and we hear music emanating from the room, the bedroom. I'm like, well, I don't even have a stereo in this house. Maybe it's my laptop. No, maybe it's my iPhone. No, you know, and it's coming from this area on the desk where there's a printer, you know, a fax machine printer. That, well, maybe they have put radios in these fax machines now. You know, they do everything else. No, it wasn't that. Pull the drawer out, and the radio's on. It's playing, you know, perfectly tuned to a station, playing this beautiful romantic music. And it's like, wow, this is incredible. Okay, so, and it played the rest of the day and night, and it went quiet the next day, and it's been dead ever since, despite my efforts to get it to work. Okay, so I wrote about it.
Pause there for a second. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Michael Shermer is our guest. His book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. We'll hear what else was heard from the transistor radio when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are lucky to have Michael Shermer back on the Jefferson Exchange. We had a replay of an earlier interview about the moral arc last Friday. Today, he's talking about his new book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia, in which he considers our thoughts about where we go when we're not here anymore, but also the search through science for ways to make sure that we stay here longer. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. We'll talk anywhere from heavens to psychic to cryonics here on the Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the radio story, your wife from Germany didn't have any family present at your wedding. The night of the wedding, she's feeling bad, missing family. And then the transistor radio she got from her grandfather is just magically playing this romantic music.
Yeah, it was quite the moving experience. Now my wife, she's an atheist like me, and you know she didn't jump immediately to the idea that, well, it's paranormal or you know grandfather is on the other side coming through in the radio. It was just more the timing of it, the emotional salience of the timing of it coming to life at that moment in a perfectly tuned station. Could have been, you know, in between stations where you just get static, and so none of that happened. Okay, so maybe it's just chance, who knows, but for us, it was the significance of it, and I wrote about this initially in Scientific American. It got a huge number of letters, mostly people that have had similar experiences. It turns out these kind of anomalous psychological experiences happen a lot, and like my friend Deepak Chopra thinks that, you know, of course there's a natural explanation, a little, you know, piece of dust on the wire, who knows. But that it's love and that sort of consciousness that connected. He's into, you know, kind of a quasi-Buddhism philosophy. There's a, you know, conscious connectedness between all people and across generations. So okay, maybe. I'm probably skeptical of that, but the idea that you don't have to you know, tune out your sensitivities to these anomalous experiences. They have emotional connectedness for people, and what's wrong with celebrating that or appreciating the mystery? So, you know, I'm open to the idea that there, you know, that we don't know everything, and I'm not going to jump to, you know, the supernatural, God, the afterlife, or anything like that. I'm skeptical of all those things, but there's still much we don't know, and who knows? And so, why not just appreciate the mystery and leave it at that? So that was my conclusion, and I think a lot of people appreciated that because, you know, I'm a pretty hardcore atheist, but the fact that an atheist can also be open to new ideas like this and admit, you know, we don't know everything. There's always a residue of unexplained anomaly in any science, in any field, in any area of knowledge. And it's good to recognize that because people do have these experiences, a lot of people, and, you know, they don't know what to do with them. So I say, you don't have to do anything. Just appreciate the mystery and live a good life.
We've got about a dozen minutes left, and calls are beginning to line up on the phone. Let's go to Bill in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Shermer.
Hi, thanks for taking me. I've always been fascinated by this subject because I'm didn't ever quite fall for all the afterlife that religion throw at you. And I liked the movie back in the 70s called Beyond and Back. My main call questioning is about a movie in the 70s or about a flight Eastern Airlines flight that flew from New York to Florida and crashed in the Everglades, and supposedly the flight engineer died, but he kept reoccurring, and people that knew him would know his presence would actually see him in parts of the plane that were salvaged and put in other planes. And I wonder if you ever heard of the book, and I have a question about that, if you did.
Yeah, I don't know that particular case. Again, there's a lot of stories, thousands of stories like that. What we do know is that people do sense the presence of people that are not there in the room. I write about this in one of my earlier books, The Believing Brain, about the sense presence effect, like alpinist climbers, you know, Everest climbers or solo sailors, pilots that are alone, the Iditarod dog sledders, you know, when you're alone for a long period of time, maybe fatigued, sleep deprived, whatever, your brain turns on at some weird place in there and it generates another person, a sense that there's somebody else in the room. And, you know, of course, we don't sense our brain doing anything. So the perception is, well, there actually is somebody else in the room, even though this person disappears shortly after. Our brains are capable of quite remarkable, anomalous experiences like this. And in Heavens on Earth, I write about Eben Alexander's trip to heaven. This is the neurologist that wrote that book, Proof of Heaven. The proof is he went there when he was in a coma. Okay, so right off the bat there, it's kind of a internal state on his own. And to me, when I read these accounts, they sound indistinguishable from, say, Oliver Sacks's accounts of his neurological patients that had these weird things happen to them, or his own trips in the 60s when he dropped acid and tried hallucinogens.
And got on the bus. Hey, I love that story.
Yeah, totally. It's just so amazing. And to the person that has the experience, it's very real for them. But to the outside, to me, reading the accounts, they all sound the same. So, you know, I have no doubt Eben Alexander took a trip in his mind somewhere. But what he wants to make it out to be is, like, I actually went to this place, and you get to go, too, in your own place. No, I think that's going too far, because we know the brain is quite capable through sleep deprivation, through oxygen deprivation, through hallucinogens, through electrical stimulation during brain surgery, through all these different techniques of generating those kinds of things that are strictly in the brain itself.
Let's take a call from Val in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Shermer.
I guess you said Val.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering what your guest Michael might think about wishful thinking and how that might be involved in the belief in hereafter, and just how that might affect us.
All right. Thanks for that, Val.
Yeah, wishful thinking, it's a little bit broad of a term. You know, cognitive psychologists study cognitive biases, specific things that lead you to believe certain things that may not be real, like the confirmation bias and the hindsight bias and the availability bias and all these things. In this case of the afterlife, I think it's not so much wishful thinking as that we project our sense that there's a self, say, a soul, a mind. I mean, like, I'm a strict materialist, but I feel intuitively like it's not just my brain up there. Like, there's thoughts floating around. That's what it feels like. And that's what our language, you know, my brain, my arm, like these are two different things. Like, there's a me and then there's my brain. Well, we know from neuroscience, it's just your brain. There's nothing outside of that. But on the other hand, it doesn't feel like that. So we naturally project into something, someplace else that we continue on. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, that we're natural-born dualists. We just have this feeling like there's a mind and a soul that continues. And the other problem is that it's not possible to conceive of being dead, because to conceive of anything, you actually have to be alive. So, like with anesthesia, you know, it's just lights out. There's nothing to conceive of what's beyond that. There's just nothing. You can't even imagine what that's like. Because to imagine anything, you have to be conscious. So, you know, we hit that wall there, and so we don't even know how to talk about it. We don't have the right words for it.
Let's see. There's an email here from Robert in Fort Bragg who says, okay, if there's no life after death, how can you explain Keith Richards?
Yes, okay.
Well done, Robert.
Well
Thanks for
played,
that.
Yes. Sir. Well played.
Let's take a call from Michael and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, go ahead.
Excuse me. Let me get off speaker. I'd like to hear an explanation for an experience that I had across a firm.
You're fading. I'm sorry, Michael. We're going to have to skip you this time. That cell phone just wasn't carrying the signal well enough. Ronnie in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Ronnie, you there? Okay, that sounds like the situation where people aren't aware of the fact that we're on a 10-second delay, and so they listen through the radio and don't hear us. There is a reference in the book to Lee's been asked the question, if there's a belief that we need an afterlife to stay motivated in life.
Yes, there are some people that think that. There's a whole theory I deal with in Chapter 1 called terror management theory that's based on the idea that we're the only species that's aware of our own mortality, and as such, we are motivated to avoid the terror that realization creates, and therefore we become artists and poets and architects and scientists and engineers and so on. We create civilization to squelch the anxiety that the idea that this is all there is it creates. And I don't think so. I think people are motivated by other things for most of what we do. Most people, most of the time, are not thinking about death. They're not walking around in a state of anxiety about it, not even unconsciously, that this theory suggests. So I think there's other motivations that are far more powerful. Love, for example, is a much more positive emotion than anxiety, death, terror, and so on. I think what the idea of awareness of our own mortality does help us focus in a positive way, and this is how I end the book, is that whether there's an afterlife or not, we don't live there. We live here, in the here and now. I call this Alvey's Error, named after Alvy Singer, Woody Allen's character in Annie Hall,
right.
Where you know, when he's a little boy, you know, he has this flashback and he won't do his homework, and his mother takes him to the doctor. Alvy, how come you don't do your homework? Because the universe is expanding. The universe is expanding, yes. It's all there is, and if the universe expands, it'll break apart, so nothing matters, so I won't do my homework. And his mother yells at him, we don't live there. We live in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn's not expanding. So that's the point of my last chapter in Heavens on Earth, is that, you know, we don't live in the afterlife. Whether there is one or not is kind of irrelevant. We live here now, so make the most of it. You got to do your homework. You got to do stuff that matters, because this is what we have now, whether there's something else or not.
When I stop to think about the popular culture renditions of heaven, you know, I'm just thinking about, the heaven with the wings and the harps and all the fluffy clouds and stuff like that. I realize that it works into much younger material, too, you know, and it was referenced in, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the depictions of the souls of the cartoon characters leaving as they laugh themselves to death. So it referenced earlier cartoons that showed that sort of thing happening. So, I mean, even as kids, we're exposed to this idea that our souls go someplace else.
That's right. Yep, it happens very early. So, again, I think we are natural-born dualists. We just tend to think there's something else. It's just a byproduct of the brain and consciousness and how our cortex is structured. We're not aware of the brain's operations and so on. But that doesn't mean there is, of course. There's a lot of things, you know, I would like to be true, but that doesn't make them true just because I want them to be true. So with science, we're trying to drill down and find out what's really true. And now, this gets to the question of what do you mean by true? It can't just be what I think and what my personal intuitions and instincts tell me are true, because we know from research that this is not reliable at all. So that's why we need others to confirm our beliefs or disconfirm our beliefs, which is why free speech and open dialogue and conversation with others is so important.
So you are an optimist, though. I mean, you're thinking that we'll figure out something at least to make our lives a little longer at some point?
Totally, yes. I'm optimistic in several senses. First of all, thanks to modern medicine and public health measures and so on, more and more of us get to live longer and longer lives. You know, the average lifespan keeps going up, you know, and in that sense, you know, that's good news for our species, for our society and so on. But I'm not against these people, the transhumanists and the singularitarians and the cryonics people. I hope they succeed. And But when they tell me, Shermer, don't you want to live to be 500 years or 1,000 years? I say, look, just get me to 80 without cancer. Get me to 90 without Alzheimer's. Get me to 100 so I'm not on a morphine drip in a bed with tubes. You know, I don't want to live like that. If you just solve those problems so that more and more of us can live healthy, mentally alert lives longer, don't worry about the 500 years. I don't live 500 years from now. I live now, and I just want to get it to tomorrow and the next year and so on.
The late Christopher Hitchens is quoted in the book several times, and it struck a chord with me to hear what he said about life as a party.
Yes, Hitch said, the thing is that you're at this great party, and then you're tapped on the shoulder, and you're told you have to leave, and worse, the party's going to go on without you. You know, and I think that's one of the things about death that is kind of sad is that, you know, that life goes on. I mean, we see people die around us all the time, celebrities, whatever, people we know. And yet life just the next day, you know, the obit is gone. It was published yesterday and life just goes on. It's like, dang, I'm going to miss that. Although Hitch also points out that the idea of certain kinds of heaven are not so good. He called the Christian version of heaven celestial North Korea. You have this all-powerful, all-knowing dictator that knows everything you're thinking and makes you, you know, it's like, what? I don't want to, that doesn't sound like a good place to go. So there, you know, it says you're tapped on the shoulder at the party and told you can never leave. Oh, no.
Wow. The afterlife and science is so much more considered in Michael Shermer's book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael Shermer, always a pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.